Hello. That's a start. You're paying attention. We'll see if you still are at the end. So if anyone who doesn't know me, my name is Amanda, although many of you have known me since the days when I used to arrive in a baby carrier. You haven't seen me around quite as much lately. That's because I've been at university and I've been studying theology, which is part of why I am allowed to do this. I'm now in my second year. Over the last 19 months, I studied Old Testament and New Testament, from the similarities with the Babylonian flood stories to Passion Christology in the Fourth Gospel. I've written essays on the story of Abraham and the Gospels of Mark, Luke and John. No, not Mark. Matthew, Luke and John, but still not Mark. As well as on different theologies of Jesus, early church councils, theories of religion and first century Judaism. And I'm sure I've missed quite a lot of things out. Today I'm going to be talking about the Sermon on the Mount, as you can probably see. And apart from my work on Matthew's Gospel, obviously what's going to become very obvious is that I spent my first year learning New Testament Greek. I've really loved getting to grips with the Gospels in the form in which they're originally read and written, and all the little linguistic insights that you can get from the Greek, which you just can't get across in English. I've tried to keep the amount of Greek in here reasonable, but if I deviate from my notes and start getting overexcited about it, then just cough to get my attention and give me panic eyes and I'll come back to my notes, okay? Okay. So, today's is the first in a series on the Sermon on the Mount, which is possibly the most famous cornerstone of Christian teaching ever. It's recorded in Matthew chapters 5-7, which we'll be working through in chunks over the next few weeks. And I have the privilege of starting with verses 1-6. Which includes the brief introduction and the first four of what we call the Beatitudes. The Sermon on the Mount is often thought of as Jesus laying down the rules of Christianity. We all have heard the formula, "You've heard it said, but I say to you," in which he expands on and reworks the Old Testament law. Then there's the Lord's Prayer, which teaches us how to pray, as well as shorter commandments such as "Do not store up treasures on earth," or "You cannot serve both God and wealth," which we're all used to. It may right now seem a long time ago, as you mentioned, but last weekend it was actually Easter. And it's very appropriate, I think, that this series is going to follow on after Easter. Because Jesus' death and resurrection must always be prioritized over ethics and commandments. We can never forget that Jesus does teach us, as is going to become very obvious, but his person, revelation, and death come absolutely first. We can bear this in mind as we go on both today and in the next weeks. We see this priority actually in Matthew's Gospel itself, as the Sermon on the Mount is not the first thing he writes about. It's preceded by four chapters which show us who Jesus is. Matthew writes about the events of Jesus' birth, the coming of the Magi, the flight into Egypt, and then John the Baptist's preaching. He calls the first disciples. There's the temptation in the wilderness and the mission in Galilee. All of these events demonstrate to us who Jesus is before Jesus ever sits down and teaches us what he wants of us. So, we come to the Sermon on the Mount itself. I have a note for a slide, I can't remember what it is though. Does this work? There we go. We call it the Sermon on the Mount because, as you can read there, Matthew begins, "When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up a mountain." The Latin title of this section is therefore Sermo in Monte, hence Sermon on the Mount. Mountains are often actually a very significant motif or symbol in various faiths, including throughout the Old Testament. For example, there's Mount Horeb, where Elijah heard the still small voice of God. There's Mount Zion, which is where the temple is. According to Ezekiel, Eden was on the mountain, although I haven't heard that anywhere else. Mount Gerizim is the place where Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac, and it's where the Samaritans thought that the temple ought to be. In Roman paganism, there's of course Mount Olympus, or Greek paganism, which is where the gods dwelled. But in this case, the mountain that almost certainly came to mind for the original readers would have been Mount Sinai. When Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt into the wilderness, he was summoned up Mount Sinai, where he met one-on-one with God. When he came down, he was carrying the stone tablets of the Ten Commandments, and he also brought with him the Torah law, which would define the Israelites' relationship with God from that time onwards. Also, his face was glowing. apparently that happens when you meet face to face with God. Matthew actually develops what we call a Moses typology in the beginning of his gospel. By that, I mean that the events of Jesus' life, which he records up to this point, very closely resemble the events of Moses' life. I'll explain. After Jesus is born, Mary and Joseph escape with him into Egypt, which, as we know, is a major part of the Exodus story, so that he comes out of there in the same way the Israelites do in Exodus. Then Jesus takes a 40-day trip into the wilderness, where he's tempted with food and power, in the same way that the Israelites are tempted during their 40 years of wandering in the desert. When they succumb to temptation, however, Jesus succeeds in refusing it. And after that, in the same order as happens in the Exodus narrative, Jesus goes up a mountain and teaches in the same way that Moses does. All of these parallels serve to show us that Jesus is the same kind of paradigm leader that Moses was. He changes everything in the same way that Moses basically wrote the first four books of the Bible, the second to fifth books of the Bible. You can hardly underestimate the importance of Moses for the Israelites, for the Judeans at the time of Jesus, or for modern Jews. The law which he delivered governs every aspect of their life and relationship with God. But there is just as much contrast to be drawn from the comparison with Moses as there is similarity. Because of the parallel between Sinai and the Sermon on the Mount, we could easily expect that Jesus will begin with a new Jesus version of the Ten Commandments. But instead of instructions like, you shall have no other gods, or you shall not misuse the name of the Lord, you shall not murder, instead we read this: blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. These aren't commandments, they're statements. Rather than instructing us to follow certain rules, these Beatitudes present a divine worldview. And this is something that I hope to come on to more later, once I've demonstrated it in a bit more detail. Another contrast. At Sinai, God appears to one man and is strictly inaccessible to anyone else. In Exodus 19:12, we read, put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. In contrast, Jesus, who is himself God in human form, teaches so that all people can hear. We know the disciples gather around him, but also the crowds who have followed him from Galilee. They can all hear equally, not simply those who have been chosen. This is essentially the miracle of the incarnation. The God no longer sets boundaries between himself and his people to protect his holiness, but instead he comes right into the middle of the crowd and he teaches so that everyone can hear him. As I mentioned, when Moses comes down from the mountain, he has to put a bag over his head because his face is glowing, and apparently people are intimidated by that. But when Jesus finishes his sermon, he comes down the mountain and he goes on teaching and healing. He is surrounded again by crowds who come up to him and are able to petition him directly. There isn't that same mediatorship needed between God and people. He's just there. I want to highlight this term disciples, which we see in the second verse up there, because it's the first time in the gospel that Matthew uses it. Crucially, the word disciples doesn't yet mean the 12, which is what we tend to assume if we see the disciples. In fact, in Matthew, at this point, only Peter, Andrew, James, and John have yet been called by Jesus. So who does the disciples mean? Well, in Greek, the disciples is hoi mathetai, which comes directly from the verb manthano, which means I learn. A disciple, therefore, is fundamentally someone who learns. Incidentally, we can say the same about the Greek word, where disciple comes from the Latin word disco, which means I learn. I once heard of a school who wanted their motto to be I hear, I see, I learn, but they were made to change it because they put it in Latin and it was audio, video, disco. Incidentally, if you ever like to say, I learn through suffering in Latin, if that ever comes up, it's disco inferno. So this event is where Jesus' followers become his disciples. They stop just following him around as he does miracles, and they sit down and they learn from him. Moreover, this type called disciples isn't just reserved for the 12, but refers to everyone in the crowd who comes and listens to him. In the same way, we can become disciples of Jesus. We can follow him around and look at what he's doing, or we can sit and we can listen and we can learn. And that is how you become essentially a disciple, one who learns from him. So I turn to the passage in question today, which we have up there. As I mentioned, it's the very beginning of the three-chapter sermon. Leading up to this, we've had a recording of Jesus' ministry in Galilee. Immediately before these verses, we read from Matthew. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all the sick, those who were afflicted with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, and paralytics, and he cured them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. Between that passage and this one, the pace has changed dramatically. From performing miracle after miracle after miracle in the middle of crowds of people, curing leprosy here, a paralytic there, casting out a demon, constantly surrounded by people begging for his attention, Jesus withdraws and slows everybody down so that they can listen to him. As we learn from the Sermon on the Mount in the following weeks, I invite you to emulate this stillness. Jesus doesn't teach during his itinerancy because everybody's too busy. They're too overwhelmed. They're rushing too much to concentrate. As we go through this series, bring yourself to sit on the mountain as one of those disciples, as part of that crowd who learns from Jesus. After that hectic list of the sick, the pained, the possessed, and the suffering, of crowds coming from local towns, big cities, and beyond, Matthew puts his gospel into slow motion to focus on Jesus. If this was a film, the camera would zoom in on Jesus' mouth as we read, Jesus opened his mouth and began teaching them, saying, at this point I have to go briefly into the Greek, because the NIV doesn't mention Jesus' mouth at all in this passage. So, here is Matthew's gospel in Greek. Now, I'm sure there's a few people here who can read that. Thankfully, over the past couple of years, that's become me. But in sympathy for the rest of you, I've transliterated it into English so that you can at least read what it says. Underlined there, you can see anoixos tostoma autu, which is what I referred to. It literally means having opened his mouth. Anoixos is having opened tostoma, the mouth, autu, his. So he opens his mouth, and then edidasken autos legon, he began teaching them, saying. That's a very long way to say, essentially, and Jesus began the sermon. This is what I mean by Matthew slowing the pace down. I'm showing you this just to make it clear that when we pick up a Bible at home, we're working with a translation. Somebody's made choices in that translation about what to do with the text. It's something everyone knows in theory when they pick this thing up, but it's often lost in practice. In my translation, I include he opened his mouth because I'm writing translations for an exam. I have to prove that I know what that phrase means and I'm not just missing it out because I don't know what tostoma is. But in English, it's a redundant phrase. Of course Jesus opened his mouth before he spoke. We don't imagine that he mumbled his way through the Sermon on the Mount. Despite vocabulary lists and interlinear translations which tell you that this word in Greek means this word in English, translations aren't a code. One word doesn't equal another. We do our best, and often we do quite well, but sometimes you get things like that phrase there where the Greek and the English don't really add up. There we go. I wanted to put up the Greek for two reasons. Firstly, to point out that our text is a translation. Secondly, to make a quick note on the form of the Beatitudes, which I just found really interesting. I think there's a strong case that the Beatitudes are written as poetry. They're laid out like verse and translation, but in the Greek you can clearly see the repetition between lines. Every other line begins makarioi hoi, which means blessed are, and then every other line begins hoti autoi, or auton on the second one, which is essentially the same word, which means because they or because theirs. In addition, these first four Beatitudes are linked together by alliteration, which is something you never see in the English. They alliterate in with pi, which is 3.14 if you do maths, or p is transliterated. So you have tokoi and pneumati, the poor in spirit, penthuntes, which is those who are mourning, praes, the gentle, and painontes, the hungry. And then at the end there's a short delta or D alliteration in dipsontes ten dias dikosune, which is the thirsty for righteousness. I don't necessarily have a deep meaningful point to make about that. I just think it's quite cool. Okay. That's more like it. So, this does bring me, however, to the crucial term in this passage, which is makarios, which both the NIV and me translate blessed. You may have seen other translations translated as happy, so happier the poor in spirit, etc. The term is used 50 times in the New Testament, four of which are in the Beatitudes, in Matthew, and four of which are in the parallel set of Beatitudes in Luke. The title Beatitude actually comes from this repeated word, which in the Latin Vulgate translation is Beati, just meaning blessed. If we wanted to name them after the Greek, then they could be Makarisms, which I'm informed by the internet is a word in English, not that I've ever heard it before, or we could equally accurately just call them blessings. This word for blessed first appears in the 6th century BC, where it describes the blissful and carefree state of the pagan gods. Beatitudes or blessings, therefore, are the opposite of curses. They invoke happiness and fortune for the recipient. It's much like stating, I hope you have a good day tomorrow, or blessed are you because you have done something great for me today. The form would have been very familiar to both Jesus and his audience from the many parallel kinds of blessings in the Old Testament. For example, happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, which is Psalm 1:1. Or from Job, how happy is the one whom God reproves. Or my particular favourite from a text in the 2nd century BC known as Ben Sira, which you may find if you have an Apocrypha section in your Bible. Happy the man who lives with a sensible wife and the one who does not plough with oxen ass together. I'm yet to understand why those two blessings need to be linked. So the early Christians, including the disciples and the evangelists and Jesus, would have read the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Old Testament. In that, all of these blesseds and happies are translated using the same word that Matthew uses here, i.e. makarios. There's clearly something insufficient about translating makarios as just happy, because then we end up reading, happy are those who mourn. So we have to understand the Beatitudes as describing something more than just positive emotion. I quite like the translation fortunate, because it encompasses that you can be in a good position without necessarily being happy. But blessed is actually better, because it includes God's role in creating that good fortune. So, who is blessed? Well, the four P's, which I mentioned earlier. The ptokoi, the poor in spirit, the penthuntes, the mourning, the praes, the gentle, and the painontes, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Firstly then, the poor in spirit. Those who aren't proud. Those who do not strut about like peacocks, or the pheasant who was showing off on our lawn this morning, showing off their confidence and abilities. Those who are willing to stand to the side for someone else. Many commentators interpret poor in spirit as a state that we're all in, since we're all poor in spirit compared to Jesus and by God's standards. While I do agree that we are all spiritually lacking to some degree, I think that Jesus is making a more specific point here. The best explanation that I found draws from the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector in Luke 18. Which I'll read for you because it's quite brief. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Jesus tells us that the tax collector goes away justified, not the cocky Pharisee. The Pharisee is probably materially poorer, being a religious man, but he's presumptuous, whereas the tax collector is contrite. I think it's that same humility of person which Jesus blesses here, which defines those who will be given the kingdom of God. Secondly, and I'm afraid I have to move on quite quickly, because you could say a lot about all of these, blessed are those who mourn. Again, there's a tendency to spiritualize this as an expression of sadness at our sin. But if Jesus really meant that, I think he would have said it, in the same way that he specifies those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. In addition, the parallel version of this beatitude in Luke is, blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh, which doesn't have any kind of spiritual sense. The promise of comfort for those who are mourning is in the future tense, which I think is important. Jesus doesn't invalidate grief or sorrow by saying that comfort will come instantly. It won't. Jesus himself wept at the tomb of Lazarus. Emotion is a good and welcome part of being human in this world, but Jesus does promise a future in which he will wipe away every tear. The single word, which in the Greek means they will be comforted, is known as a divine passive. That means that the lack of any other subject suggests it will be God who does the comforting. We can know that divine comfort from the one who we know as the Comforter, the Holy Spirit. That Greek word, they will be comforted, is parakletheisontai, which comes from parakaleo, which is the root word for parakletos, or paraclete, the title for the Spirit which is most used in John's Gospel. The Spirit is our comfort when we mourn, even though as long as we are in this world, there is necessarily still mourning. Now, as I said, it's more than possible for me to give a separate sermon on each of these Beatitudes, so I'm obviously missing out some of the ways they can be developed. I encourage you sometime in the next week to go away with this text to consider what meanings it may have for you personally. That said, on to Beatitude number 3. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. I really dislike the translation meek. It always brings to my mind a mouse running around going, meek, meek, meek. Jesus doesn't ask for pushovers or doormats or mice. That's inconsistent with the Messiah who turned over the tables in the temple or who constantly stands up to the Jewish authorities every time they try to trap him. And Jesus himself is called meek by Paul. So clearly that term doesn't rule out any of his bravery. I think of the meek as the Hufflepuffs. They're the yellow and black other house from Harry Potter, the fourth one who are also present. Full disclosure, I consider myself to be a Hufflepuff. It's the best house. If you want to challenge me on that, I'll see you afterwards. Hufflepuffs are known for being kind, loyal and welcoming. But they're mocked as the miscellaneous house, who does nothing but sit around and eat cookies. True, they do sit around and eat cookies, and they won't necessarily try to prove themselves in battle or fight to do better than everyone else. But if you anger a Hufflepuff, get out of the way. When Hogwarts was attacked by Voldemort in the big finale, Hufflepuff contributed the second most students after Gryffindor. So they're hardly pushovers. They're willing to stand up and fight for what they believe in. So I prefer to translate this term praeus, which is translated meek, as the gentle, meaning those who fight for what is right without self-righteous boldness. Then, as Jesus says, the gentle gain the most, even though they don't fight for it. They inherit the earth. This reminds me of what Luke says what Jesus says in Luke 14, that it's better to take the lowest place to table and be moved up, rather than to take the highest because you feel self-important and then be moved down. If you presume little for yourself, then you will gain much. Finally for today, the fourth beatitude, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Crucially, if you're hungry for something, then you both don't have it and desperately want it. Hunger and thirst are possibly our most fundamental human instincts. And as anyone who's ever been hangry knows, they have a tendency to affect everything else. Plus, both of the words there for those who hunger and those who thirst are in the present tense, which gives them a continuous sense in the Greek. The individuals Jesus is talking about hunger and thirst continually. What do they hunger and thirst for? Righteousness, which in Greek is dikaiosune. It's a condition in which we're utterly worthy and utterly blameless. In Luke 23, the centurion at the foot of the cross declares of Jesus, "Surely this was a righteous man." Or in other translations, "Surely this man was innocent." The word he uses is dikaios, which is the adjective coming from dikaiosune. In looking for righteousness, therefore, we're aiming to emulate Jesus himself in the same way that he exemplifies meekness. But Jesus' blessing is not on the righteous, but on those who passionately seek righteousness. They are hungry, yet they are not yet filled. But here Jesus promises that if we only try, if we seek after righteousness, we will be filled. We will receive the righteousness that we're looking for. And we know that this righteousness can only be found through the very person who is declaring this blessing. So after all of that, God's blessings and ultimate successes go to the poor, the weepers, the timid, and the dreamers. It doesn't sound realistic, but that's the reality of God's kingdom. Jesus constantly turns our preconceptions on their head. The last shall be first, and the first last. The blind shall see. I come for the sick, not for the well. The Commonwealth Games, I'm told, are going on at the moment. Imagine for a moment if Jesus' ideology of an upside-down kingdom was played out on the Gold Coast. Those who hunger and thirst for victory receive it, whether or not they're actually the strongest competitors. Those who don't try to impose themselves over their competition will inherit the gold medal. It's ludicrous. But the Beatitudes are not about commandment and instruction. Jesus does not tell us to mourn or to be poor in spirit. They're about reforming our perceptions so that they conform with God's. If these Beatitudes were about commandment, then surely the fourth one would be those who are righteous as something to seek for, rather than for those who aren't quite there yet. In place of the new set of 10 commandments, which you might expect from the Sinai parallel, Jesus begins his teaching with paradigm statements, which describe the reality of the world as God sees it. The last are to be first and the first last. The weakest are to inherit the kingdom of God, and those who suffer now will be rewarded in the end. Like the disciples on the mountain, we're invited to come to Jesus and to listen, to recognise that he speaks the truth. And as we read in John, Jesus is the truth. If we can take the Beatitudes to heart, then they'll change how we view our fellow human beings, but also how we view ourselves. They invite us to find strength in weakness and to find blessing in our dependence as God's children.